Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining Ukrainian Spaces live session. And also, if you're listening in as a podcast a bit later, thank you so much for listening and joining us for one of our last episodes for this season. It's been a really bizarre time since the last time we had a live session. Ukrainian Spaces is being broadcasted live also on Twitter Spaces, and that platform was, you know, taken away from us at some point and returned back, basically once again reminding us that all our public online spaces is a borrowed land and can be taken away at any point for whatever reason. And additionally to that, most Ukrainians online report collapse in reach and engagement. And that could be a system of censorship and deprioritizing online voices online. That could be also the holiday season, and most people who are not Ukrainians just switch off from our stories. Could be both. But the fact is that our audiences online are dwindling. And unfortunately, lives of our families on the front line literally depend also on how much reach Ukrainians online have to rally support in solidarity. That's why, you know, amplifying Ukrainian voices is the least you can do to help us. So please do not take a break from that if you can afford that, and keep amplifying us online. For Ukrainian Spaces family, we're actually more lucky because we now exist on so many other platforms rather than just Twitter. We're on Instagram. We just launched a new channel on YouTube. We're present on 8+ podcast platforms as well, all thanks to our very generous Patreon family that keeps donating and supporting us. So you can check all the information where we are available on ukrainianspaces.com. And also the support allows us to branch out. Since last time we spoke, we recently launched a new sub-platform in the Ukrainian Spaces family, which is called Volya Hub. And Volya Hub is basically a storytelling hub that supports important storytelling about Russian colonialism in indigenous languages. You can check on our accounts all the links, and it's very easy to find. It's on web. It's under the address volyahub.com. And we're coming also at the end of our second season. We will have a break for live sessions in January to publish and release the backlog of all our recorded interviews and some extra bonus content for our Patreon family. But we also published this week a manifesto of our main takeaways from the season two. And before I feature our featured Ukrainian for today, I really wanted to read this manifesto of what we learned after the season two, when we decided to build bridges of anti-colonial solidarity from our allies from Global South. Why after season two, why we still think that international anti-colonial solidarity matters? It's important because as Ukrainians, we come to realize that we share a common goal of liberation with so many others internationally. And when we come together, we can share our stories and experiences and pass along the knowledge that has helped us succeed in one way or another. We all have a unique anti-colonial struggle, and we can all learn from each other to further our goals. Ukrainian Spaces Bridge episodes this season are doing and have been doing just that, creating bridges between peoples and nations that have suffered from colonialism, imperialism, and building strong bonds of solidarity. To this day, Russia is a colonial empire, and just like many others, it's not willing to let go of the territories it has colonized in the past. This has been illustrated by its multiple invasions of Georgia, Ukraine, and other sovereign states when they started to move away from its sphere of influence. Today, Ukraine is seeing a massive amount of support and understanding from countries with their own experiences with Russian aggression. They know what it's like dealing with Russia and know that together we can defeat the genocidal empire. We extend the same solidarity to anyone fighting against colonialism and imperialism worldwide. So for way too long, our colonizers have written and told our stories. The existence of Holodomor deniers and Soviet history whitewashers shows how deeply the Russian narrative has dug itself on the international level. As a result, now, in addition to surviving a genocidal war, Ukrainians have to fight the informational war where every day we're attacked by Russian bots, trolls, and brainwashed Kremlin apologists. The same tactics are employed against anyone fighting against colonialism and imperialism. All nations and people formerly and currently colonized by imperial powers are fighting a similar enemy. We all have a right to self-determination and are stronger when united in our fight. Russian propaganda bends itself backwards to prove that Ukrainians and often others that they don't like at the moment are just confused Russians and that supposedly we don't exist as a separate entity. Our goal is to always be louder because all peoples have a right to self-determination and a right to freely determine our politics and values. And over the course of the last 10 months, we have seen many weaknesses and failures of the Russian war machine. However, even bad propaganda works when there is no alternative. Therefore, it is important to amplify the voices of everyone under attack from the Kremlin. For decades, there was no alternative to Russian propaganda because it repressed and or killed anyone who tried to counter the truth. We must support and elevate each other's stories to drown out the noise designed to silence us. So this is our manifesto to end season two of Ukrainian Spaces and the lessons we learned. And I think it's a perfect bridge to intro our featured Ukrainian today because so much stuff that we just mentioned is directly linked to our conversations today. Hey.
Hi, how are you?
Slava Ukraini.
Herom Slava.
We have a golden rule for Ukrainian Spaces and all our Ukrainian featured Ukrainians and Ukrainian allies introduce themselves the way they would like. So please, if you don't mind, tell us a bit who you are, where you come from, and maybe a little bit how your life has changed in the recent 10 months.
Sure. So my name is Andrea Chalupa. In Ukrainian, that's pronounced Halupa. I was born and raised in Northern California in a farming community, sort of similar to Ukraine, called Davis, California. And I was raised by two Ukrainian refugees. My mom and dad were born in Ukrainian refugee camps after World War II. My mom's family comes from Donbas, the eastern region of Ukraine that's been under Russian occupation since 2014. My dad's family comes from Western Ukraine. So they have what Ukrainians know as a mixed marriage. My mother's family being Orthodox, my father's family being Catholic, and so on. So their wedding in New York City was very, very tense with their in-laws. So I made a really sort of unusual decision when I graduated university so many years ago to focus on Ukraine. At the time, it just seemed like a very odd thing to do. There's certainly no so-called job security in doing such a thing, but I felt very passionate about exploring about what it means to be Ukrainian and why that country means so much to me and why it should matter to the world, the long ancient history of what has produced what is known as today's modern Ukraine. And I set out on that journey by researching and writing a screenplay based on, in part, inspired by, really, my grandfather, who survived Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine. And that screenplay, which I had to ultimately produce myself because no one would produce it, is called Mr. Jones. And it was directed by the three-time Academy Award nominee Agnieszka Holland, who's also the elected chairwoman of the European Film Academy. She gave us such films as Europa, Europa, the story of a Jewish boy hiding in Hitler's youth, the original version of The Secret Garden. She's directed tons of television like House of Cards, The Wire, The Affair, and so on. And it stars James Norton, Vanessa Kirby, and Peter Sarsgaard. And that came out in 2020. And we, over the summer, we projected it onto the Russian press office in Washington, D.C. And it, of course, Mr. Jones, the film was also shut down in Moscow when Memorial tried to screen it, and the memorial shortly afterwards was shut down by Russian authorities finally. So that's my story. I also co-host the podcast Gaslit Nation with my friend Sarah Kenzier, and we talk about Ukraine a lot. We look at Ukraine as a critical, important lens of understanding Kremlin genocidal imperialism today, the Kremlin's war on democracies around the world. And that's been a show that has really prepared our audience for everything we saw unfold with the total war at the end of February, which was just the worst thing in the world, right? For us who have like focused on the Holodomor, especially, it's horrible. It's a horrible thing. It's a horrible tragedy, of course, for anyone, anywhere, especially if you've devoted so much time in studying the Holodomor, and just to see the Holodomor repeating today is just unthinkable. It's unthinkable. And to see characters like my script, Mr. Jones, the movie, the bad guy is Walter Duranty of the New York Times, who's a mouthpiece for the Kremlin. And now you have Tucker Carlson, who's a mouthpiece for the Kremlin. And so it's just been a nightmare. But at the same time, we're ready. You know, we were ready for this. We've been very organized. Ukrainians are generally extremely organized. The diaspora communities are very organized and connected because we've had to be for so long, just as a matter of survival.
Andrea, I just wanted to ask you a little bit follow up from what Maxim said, but I was wondering how your life specifically has changed, maybe even on a very day to day basis since February 24th. It's been almost 300 days now of the full-scale invasion, and I was just wondering how your life looks like now. Has anything changed, and is anything different?
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer because I also had a baby shortly, so the answer is yes, it has. But I think it's such a personal question. I think it was, you know, there was going through the process of grief. There's going through the process of mourning. I remember within days of the total war being on the phone with a old friend who happens to be the key organizer of Syria's revolution, which is still ongoing and trying to resist Putin's puppet Assad. And he's been the face of the Syrian resistance against Assad and Putin for many years. He's lost family and loved ones to Russia and Assad. And I remember being on the phone with him within days of what happened, you know, with this, February 24, and just crying to my Syrian friend. And he was so cool, calm, and collected. And he walked me through everything that we needed to do in those initial hours. And together we joined forces with the Syrian resistance, with the White Helmets and others, and launched the Syria-Ukraine Network, SUN, to basically share best practices from Syrians, what they learned, you know, the whole thing about how the Russians will bomb a hospital, and then the first responders will show up, and then the Russian plane will circle back and bomb the first responders. And so all of these lessons from what the Syrians had to endure, we tried to collect those and translate those lessons into Ukrainian and get it circulated among Ukrainian organizers and so on. It was a very, like everyone, it was a very frantic time. And I was trying to say yes to every media invitation, every speaking engagement to try to fact check. I would go from crying, sobbing like anybody, to suddenly having to clean myself off and appear on live TV and be coherent. I was very early in saying, yes, this is genocide, and fact checking people that were clutching their pearls over such a statement. You know, I took my leadership during that time from Ukrainians in Ukraine. They wanted a no-fly zone. I went on TV and said they need a no-fly zone. And I was an easy target because I'm not over there. I'm not a Ukrainian born in Ukraine. And so but I was amplifying their messages to try to say, because that's what they want, that's what they need. We need to listen to them. They know best. They're the ones. Ukraine is a country that has successfully resisted Kremlin aggression for generations. The fact that Ukraine still exists after what Russia has tried to do to it is a miracle. I always say the existence of Ukraine is a miracle. So we need to learn and take leadership from Ukraine and Ukrainians themselves. And so I did everything I could to amplify those messages, even when I had just delivered a baby. So, you know, it was just a process of how my life changed, of just being in just having sleepless nights, not just because of the baby, but like having sleepless nights and just really doing everything I possibly can from where I am and just drawing attention to that. And my daughter was born on Holy Saturday, which is the day between Good Friday of the crucifixion and Sunday of the resurrection. And there's a saying for Christians that Holy Saturday is when it's all dark and quiet and you think that you've lost, but really it's because God's hard at work, because that's the day Jesus goes down to hell and defeats death. And then he rises up the next morning. And so the fact that my daughter came into the world on that day, which also ironically happens to be Antony Blinken's birthday, that for my family was such a wonderful symbolic sign for us that we desperately needed. And it was also a time when the war was changing, where it was turning in Ukrainians' favor, thanks to Ukrainians. They were gaining the initiative. And so, you know, I guess it's also changed where I've gone through my own difficult conversations with my own faith and God and the meaning of life. And also it's changed in just the conversations I've had with my ancestors, with the historical figures that I lean on for guidance to navigate these times. And it's just been, you know, it's just been a time of really clinging to the light in a time of such darkness and pushing back and fighting back and really finding your resilience no matter what.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's on one hand, it's very very personal and very powerful. On the other hand, I hope he will not take offense, but of all the episodes we had over like 50 and Ukrainians coming and sharing the most personal stuff, there's one clear pattern, the same that you shared, but nobody, not a single person, not a single Ukrainian I know, just sat and did nothing. And mm-hmm. out of all of this pain and trauma that everyday people are going through, I mean, this whole genocide, somebody, like, it might, you know, that could be my very little acts of defiance of doing something, donating or volunteering to something really big, but everyone is doing something. And I think it's quintessential Ukrainian thing that just got activated in all of us. And I'm really grateful for your work and for your everyday defiance and resistance you also do. So thank you so much for it. I also wanted to ask you, because, you know, part of the reason why I really, you know, stan and adore you, because exactly what you mentioned, that lots of things that we were trying to tell the world before genocide started, we were doing that for years. And at many points, it felt like nobody listened or nobody cared or nobody valued whatever we had to say, that this is a pattern, that this is serial behavior, and there are like specific ways you can stop this. But since the last 10 months, how do you feel like, if do you feel like things are changing, or do you feel like there are still gaps in what the world understands or does not understand about what is happening right now in Ukraine?
I think there's still a ways to go. Obviously, this mythology that Ukrainians and Russians are the same person is persistent. But I think there was, at the same time, was a massive sea change for all of us who have been doing this work even before, you know, even before Euromaidan and so on. There was this incredible ignorance in the West. I know from trying to get Mr. Jones producers in the West, in LA, in New York, in London, would read my screenplay and they'd want to take the meeting with me just because they were so shocked by learning this history. They couldn't believe it. It didn't mean they wanted to produce the film because the film's so difficult, but they wanted to learn more about the history because it was just like brand new news to them. So I think all the stuff we've been saying over the years, and you know, that you've been saying, like, this is Russian genocidal terrorism, this is Russian genocidal imperialism, this is the big threat, this is the big danger, this is why NATO expanded, like all those countries jumped into NATO because they suffer their own genocides under Russia, under Kremlin occupation, and so on. I think all of those arguments that we've made in all the years prior to Putin's total war made us seem like nationalistic, made us seem like extreme. Like people have cognitive dissonance in accepting that Russia, the Kremlin, could be deliberately, intentionally, systematically that evil. They simply could not accept what we were saying for so long. And we seemed hysterical. We really did to these people. And we saw in the way they ignored us and the way they would troll us and so on and dismiss us. And then, unfortunately, this is the worst kind of vindication always. People finally got to see for themselves in all of the horrific headlines flooding out of what we were talking about. They got to see it themselves. They got to be horrified themselves with these news of you know, mass rapes, systemic rapes, including of children and so on and so on. And we're like, what do you think we've been trying to tell you? You know, mass graves, deliberate starvation, just all of it. And so that's been, in a weird way, that's made our jobs significantly easier. There's now a shorthand that we can have with people because they believe us. You know, it's like we don't have that credibility issue we did for so long because Russia was so dominant in the narrative. And we were stuck dealing with journalists in newsrooms and in think tanks who came up in Ivy League universities studying Russia and Ukraine through a Moscow lens. You know, now the decolonization has started. Is just getting started, and it's minting a lot of incredible experts, including experts who aren't Ukrainian, which is important as well. And so I think we have to keep working on this and working on this and doing what, like, exactly the kind of work that you guys are doing, which is why I'm so honored that you'd asked me on your show. And I'm so grateful for all the work that you are doing and the guests that you have on this show. That is the new generation, and that you guys are the ones planting seeds that are going to protect Ukraine today and protect Ukraine for future generations.
And we're obviously unbelievably happy to have you here with us and to round off our season with an interview with you. But I also wanted to ask you, I know this is something you've spoken about before, but, you know, obviously we Ukrainians, even if we were born abroad, even if we lived abroad, like, of course, even if we're third generation, even if we're first generation, we will care about Ukraine. We always have something that ties us back home, no matter, you know, how long ago our parents or our ancestors in general left Ukraine. But why do you think Ukraine and what's happening in Ukraine right now is actually much bigger than just a thing that's happening for people with connections to Ukraine? Why do you think what's happening in Ukraine matters to everyone in the world? And yeah, I mean, does it?
Yeah, of course. And I'll tell you from an American perspective. So the year 2020 was just such a toxic year. It just felt like we were just in the doldrums. It just felt like such a sad year. And there was all this toxic fighting in America. And then Putin and the FSB, they did it. They went total war on Ukraine. And for a moment there in America, and it's still there, Americans became united, like left, right, and center, Republicans, Democrats, Independents. We became overwhelmingly united as a country. Like I've never experienced that, not since like 9/11. You'd have like people on TV, like for the longest time, I'd like cringe when people would talk about Ukraine on TV because the non-Ukrainians, because of their ignorance or their Moscow lens towards the country. And you'd have these experts on TV saying, hell yeah, we're going to pay more for our gas. You know, so this like this court esprit, this like storming the barricade spirit took over America and Ukrainian flags everywhere. And it was just this strange moment of unity that I've never felt before. And I know this is like a silly, frivolous sounding example of it, but, you know, SNL being a comedy show, they opened with an extremely somber cold open of the show with a song for Ukraine, with a prayer for Ukraine, something that you hear in Ukrainian churches. this. And it was just like this surreal moment of people finally seeing what we're talking about. And if I'm crying, it's like, because I said, you know, I'm doing the damn work, I'm showing up, but I'm also processing grief because it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable what's happening. And everything, the genocide, it's constantly on my mind. There's never, it's the soundtrack is always there in my mind. I can't escape the images. I can't escape the stories. And that's how it should be. So just if I'm crying, it's because I'm just processing still a lot, but it doesn't mean I'm slowed down. I'm actually like doubling my efforts. We have, of course, a new Congress coming in. And you asked, you know, how has my life changed? Well, normally in an election, you know, my podcast, Gaslit Nation, we always do get out the vote events. Our podcast, Gaslit Nation, is dedicated to calling out corruption in America, calling out the threat of autocracy worldwide, and saying, you know, we're shining a light on all these horrible crises, and we're going to tell you what to do about it to protect yourselves, and how grassroots power is the most reliable power you've left. So every election, midterms, presidential, we always do get out the vote events. We always drive people to make phone calls, knock on doors, do whatever you can to get people to vote. It's so important. We're passionate about that work. So this year, because of how Republicans have been, how they've been, you know, Russian disinformation machine, led by Tucker Carlson on Fox News, we tripled our efforts. We did significantly far more events than we've ever done to try to protect Ukraine by getting as many patriots, American patriots, into Congress. And the whole country united because this was such an important midterms. And I made well over 1,000 phone calls to get out the vote to voters in Arizona and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Georgia and so on. And I talked to a lot of people, including independents, who are so scared about Russia and fascism, and we've got to do more for Ukraine. And so, and one woman like prayed with me on the phone about Ukraine. So I just want people to know that when you see a lot of the Republicans, you know, the trashy Republicans like Don Jr., Marjorie Taylor Greene, those Republicans that are coming, especially into the House of Representatives, they're a problem for all Americans. They're not just a problem for Ukraine. So when you hear those Republicans speaking Kremlin talking points, they're really driven by Tucker Carlson of Fox News. They're driven by their own fascism. And but they are in the minority view, and they are a threat, not just to Ukraine, they're a threat to American democracy. And what you saw with this historic midterms, with Democrats and independents uniting and bucking the historical trend of winning a massive historic amount of seats in Congress, I think this is the first time that the incumbent president, where his party kept the Senate, and all these state legislatures for the president's party stayed in office and so on, first time in like generations, right? That was because we share the same enemy, which is fascism. Whether it's Marjorie Taylor Greene or Putin, it's the same enemy.
I wanted to just ask you, Andrea, maybe just to follow up, and I was speaking about with my dad about this actually, that, you know, after the, like during the Soviet Union and then when the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia actually had loads of like correspondents in Washington and loads of people who were like all, you know, operating in the US, and, you know, a really strong network that basically now has transformed and continues essentially operating in a way. I don't know if this is like massive conspiracy theory. I don't think it is, because it's natural, right? Like there were exchanges of people and stuff like that. And I was just wondering, like, from your perspective, and it's interesting to hear as well that you were talking about specific people, you know, repeating a lot of messages that are harmful, and specifically, you know, we clearly see that they repeat a narrative that is too familiar to us, a narrative that has been, you know, fueling what's happening in Ukraine, and we recognize it when we hear it. But I was just wondering, and I don't know if you want to answer this, but just would be interested to hear I know you said already that they do repeat certain individuals in their rhetoric, but in general, do you think that there's like something wider, like, I don't know, speaking points that come out of specific places, or just kind of, do you think there's something historical about this relationship?
Oh, hell yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So it's a combination. It's historical. And then it's a product of America's abysmal dark money campaign finance laws. So there's a lot of like Kremlin linked Russian dark money going around, not just to political parties, but also the New York Times just ran a piece saying that that the FBI, the American intelligence community, is concerned about the level of Kremlin-linked money that's infiltrating America's tech industries, including universities and so on. So it's a larger problem. So when you see Kremlin puppets in the Congress on TV saying Kremlin talking points, like, Kremlin dark money in some shape or form is not far behind. And that's just a given. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump, for instance, an infamous case, there was a 400-page Mueller report by the former director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, who said, you know, that documented all the connections between Trump's campaign and Russia. I mean, that's just and Trump's kids, who are central to his enterprises, have said that they're dependent on Russian money. So, yeah. And I think, obviously, the historical aspect of this is extremely important to understand as well, because we had an America First movement that was a big threat to us, our national security, in the 1930s, in the lead up to World War II. And they were a huge pain for President Roosevelt to have to deal with. He had this isolationist Republican Party that controlled Congress that kept wanting to pass these neutrality acts to keep America out of the war. And it impacted polling in America, where you'd have polls saying that, you know, the majority of Americans, you know, felt badly for what was happening to Jewish people in Europe, but they cared about the economy. And you'd have these polls even saying that, you know, American people blame Jewish people. There must be something they must be doing causing, you know, all the violence against them in Europe and so on. So things were very difficult back then for the plight of Europe, especially, of course, the genocide against Jewish people. It was a nightmare scenario for what was going on. Ukraine does not have nearly that great of an enemy today in the United States, because we're largely united. We're largely angry. And again, the majority of people, including the majority of voters that pulled off a historic win in these midterms, share the same enemy as you. And that enemy is, again, fascism.
You know, like, these days, I think a lot of Ukrainians who are also for the first time discovering a lot of nuance, a lot of details, and educate themselves on the politics outside Ukraine, which hasn't been the thing for many of us for many years, which is also a side effect of you know, decolonization and colonized mindset. But this is a separate story. But I feel like these days, when suddenly I stumble upon a Russia supporter in a country where I don't know anything about local politics and I'm completely ignorant, there is still a certain fascist vibe that I instantly recognize. And that's why, like, I'm very grateful for the work you've been doing even before genocide, but also trying to call out that what we're dealing with and the Ukraine story is much bigger than just Ukraine. And it's more about the ultimate fight between fascism and the free world. And I know that might sound a bit cheesy, but it is true. Because when I see Russia supporters somewhere else abroad, I instantly can predict their talking points because they exchange them. I instantly can feel the fascist vibe that it's there and what they support, what they don't. And usually not only about Russia, it's only about some so-called values, you know, that some people can be better and more human than some other people and all this fascist stuff. So I really appreciate you kind of building that bridge for your own audience, you know, for fellow Americans as well, to kind of to get them to see that this story is bigger. And I think on some basic level, most people do feel that, because I met probably thousands of Ukrainian supporters in recent months, and they might not know much about Ukraine in general, but they just feel that this is right side of the history, and they need to stand on that side and do whatever they, you know, can do to support Ukraine. Sorry, it's just like a side comment, but I w really wanted to ask you a question linked to that. And at this point, what do you feel like, what the main aspect of Ukraine's story that a lot of foreigners and Americans, but largely still missing and still do not get right?
See, I think where there's a problem is there's a tendency, I would say a well-intentioned tendency, to negotiate with Russia. And I think part of that good intention comes from foreigners wanting to make the horror stop. They want to make the pain stop. They want to make all the violence go away. And they think if Ukraine and Russia can just sit down and negotiate, it'll stop. And they don't understand that Ukraine's been trying to negotiate with Russia for 8 years now, since Russia first started its invasion. And Russia has just broken so many treaties with Ukraine, of course, and they just don't understand Russian history. So I think that's number one. And you see Americans, including on the left, who are wonderful in progressive spaces in America, who are strong allies and organizers in progressive spaces, promoting this idea of negotiating a peace deal with Russia, and even in exchange for land for peace. And what they're doing is literally promoting Chamberlain, Neville Chamberlain's deal with Hitler, which is notorious, obviously, because it's one of like the biggest it's just considered today, obviously, one of the clownish things a British prime minister has probably ever done, and that's saying a lot for British prime ministers. And obviously, land for peace did not work with Hitler, and it's not going to work with Putin. People are people. We're dealing with human nature. There are just some people and some cultures that are wired for evil, and it doesn't mean they're beyond repair. Russia could absolutely be a democracy, and that could process could begin in our lifetimes. I definitely hold out hope for that. Just like Germany overcame its dark past, but what the lesson from Germany is that you once you've been there, once you've gone into the deep end of evil, you must be hyper vigilant. You must honor history, historical truth. You must teach your history. In America, we struggle with that as well when it comes to taking down genocidal symbols like statues of Robert E. Lee and other slave owners and other traitors to our country and so on. Like we're trying to exorcise that demon out of us as well, because we've gone into the dark side as well, just like where Russia is currently. So countries can come back. Russia can come back from this, but it's not going to be overnight. It's not going to be through some shallow peace deal. It's not going to be through appeasement. It's going to be through, it has, the only way to do it is through a decisive military victory for Ukraine.
Yep, absolutely. We will start wrapping up soon, but I really wanted to come back to something you started in the beginning, and it's about your absolutely brilliant, and I cannot even underscore how important historically the work with Mr. Jones and the championing the global awareness about Holodomor genocide. But if you can, you don't mind coming back to that work. I feel these days that really the lessons about that genocide, that one of the worst genocides ever happened in human history in terms of how many people were slaughtered, are still not learned enough. And specifically, the issue of the Western complicity in it. Because the story you tell is very simple, how the West helped to cover up for that murder, mass murder of millions of people, and the exact reason why so many few people know about it to the day is lies within that cover up. And when we hear today still this, you know, the Durante school of journalism still exists. People still deny that there is a genocide happening in Ukraine. People still deny that there is anything wrong with what Russia is doing to Ukrainian people. It makes me feel like people haven't learned that lesson yet. Would you agree? And do you think it's a good opening and it's a good timing to keep talking about the Holodomor genocide because it still carries those unlearned lessons to this very day?
Without question. I mean, we're entering the 90th anniversary of the Holodomor. 2023 is going to be the 90th anniversary. And in the diaspora, we're getting ourselves organized. We're going to do screenings of Mr. Jones. We're going to do a lot of big events around this and really try to engage with all the broader communities across the country. I'm in regular touch with a lot of diaspora groups and the embassy, in a Ukrainian embassy in Washington, D.C., and so on. And we want to make it a very big thing next year, all year, and keep that conversation going, because the lesson of the Holodomor is it's what's happening today. You have what Lenin and Stalin allegedly called useful idiots. You have the Tucker Carlsons, the Kremlin disinformation machines. They're active. And on top of that, even more insidious, you have big industry, big business, and their Western enablers, countries like France and Germany, that are desperate to go back to business as usual with Russia. And that's why they talk, you know, have hollow words like negotiations and off-ramps and so on. And you see these same characters in my film, Mr. Jones. There's a scene taken from real life where there was a big old party, a fancy party in the Waldorf Astoria in Manhattan, celebrating with Russian officials and titans of American industry, right in 1933, celebrating that America and the Soviet Union were going to be united. This really did happen. It was reported on in the New Yorker. This was a banquet at the Waldorf Astoria to celebrate the United States finally granting the Soviet Union official diplomatic recognition. And this opened the floodgates for American businesses to come on in and make blood money with Stalin. And those are the same forces we're up against today. And they take the form of the Koch brothers' political network, and the oil industries and so on, and the business establishment of Germany and the French and so on. So one thing I want to say, Putin, he claims to wanting to build a multipolar world, and he's succeeded in doing that because NATO has never been stronger. NATO is not the U.S. NATO is a global alliance. And what has emerged in this tragedy is that you see new global leaders, namely across Eastern European and Northern European NATO countries, who are speaking with moral courage, including several women, like the president of Estonia and Finland and so on, saying that Russia, the only negotiation with Russia is a decisive military defeat. That's it. We're going to the end. That's how we're going to decide this. That's it. And that's the only way to deal with this. And that's common sense for anybody who has studied Hitler in the 1930s. That's the only way to deal with it. And hopefully we are being called on, it's very obvious, we're being called on to relearn the lessons of the 1930s and this time get it right. This time we have to get it right. And to emphasize this point, on Gaslit Nation this week, we interviewed Tim Snyder, the historian who wrote Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. He was one of the historical advisors on my film, Mr. Jones. So Tim Snyder is on our podcast this week saying, you know, empires fall, and the way empires fall is through a military defeat. If you want to end the Russian genocidal imperialism, you need to defeat it militarily. That is the only way out of this. And that is the only way that Russia can then rebuild out of the ashes into a democracy.
I often say, I'm very honest about it, I really stand Professor Snyder, and I think he emerged as one of the most critical voices that explain Ukraine and explain it right, which is unfortunately a rare sight for a foreigner, for a Western elite scholar. However, these are the things that Ukrainians and Ukrainian scholars have been saying for decades, and nobody would listen. And I know that Professor Snyder also says that please, if you listen to me and, you know, you like my work, please amplify and listen to all those Ukrainians who've been saying the same for decades but were ignored and marginalized. So I hope the time is changing as well, and we will hear more Ukrainian voices on mainstream foreign platforms saying those truths and being allowed to say those truths on those mainstream platforms. Fingers crossed for that. So yeah, thank you. We'll have to wrap up. I think maybe I'll invite Tatiana to quote some of our listeners and some of our Patreon sponsors as well before we go to our final favorite question. Tatiana, do you want to come in?
Hello, everyone. Hi, Andrea. So I wanted to share some comments that we have on Twitter from our listeners. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. One of them is from Lana Janowska, and she says, the tendency to want to negotiate with Russia is so widespread in Eastern Europe, it's absolutely exhausting. So that's her. We have another one, another comment that is from...
I think it meant Western Europe, not Eastern.
I'm sorry, Western Europe, sorry. Yeah,
Eastern Europe knows the drill.
It's Western Europe, yeah. That's true. Sorry, everyone. But yeah, Western Europe is constantly saying, yeah, come try and negotiate. That's not going to work. We have another listener with the handle Perry Pilot saying, indeed, Andrea, the owner of this social media app was one of those Neville Chamberlain types suing for peace with Russia by being willing to give up Crimea. No, never. Defeat first, then negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
There is another Twitter listener by the name of April Sparkles One, who says the USA also struggles with more stringent punitive economic measures against the Russian Federation, like designating them a terrorist state. The genocide will end with more punitive economic measures against the Russian Federation. And then we have one of our wonderful patrons who's been supporting us pretty much since the beginning. Her name is Kate. She says, Andrea is such an incredible motivating force for good in this world. I'm so thankful for the work she has done and is continuing to do, connecting the dots between the past and now, and for doubling down in the face of fascism's attempts to gain a foothold. So that's from Kate. And I just wanted to say thank you from myself, because this has been a very empowering episode.
Oh, God, I hope so. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Well, this has been really just what I needed, apparently. I think we hold it in. We hold the grief and the anger in our bodies on a cellular level, in our hearts. And it just feels so good to come together with people who see clearly what's going on and our only way out, and are fighting for that. And I just felt like such a release talking to you. And I think it's because I just needed a big group hug. We all do from time to time. And I want to thank you all for the work that you're doing and for empowering me and being my guiding light through all of this.
Thank you. This is 100% mutual. And these are sessions to always educate the rest of the world about Ukraine, but first and foremost for our fellow Ukrainians to feel at home and safe space, something that we were unfortunately lacking elsewhere. So thank you so much. Andrea, the last question that we wanted to ask before we let you go is our favorite one, and it is what it means for you to be a Ukrainian these days, and has it changed maybe in any way in the last 10 months?
Nothing has changed. I think the world is finally seeing what I've known my whole entire life and what I grew up with, which is that Ukrainians are fearless, they're creative, they're hilarious, they're charming, they're tenacious, and they have such a, you know, I don't know how do I say this, but there's such a goodness in the culture. There's such a goodness in the culture. And I think it's because the whole spirit of Ukraine has had to survive and exist through a lot of Ukraine's leading artists, a lot of Ukraine's leading thinkers. And you saw these guys appearing on, you know, in murals on the barricades in Euromaidan, like Taras Shevchenko and Lesya Ukrainka. You saw them. They're there for a reason, because that's how Ukraine has survived so long. Through art, through creativity. And there's just such a beautiful spirit in that. And it's so hard for people to understand and explain it. But that's what I lived and breathed growing up through my family. And I'm so grateful for that. And now the world sees it on display as Ukrainians are inspiring the world.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for donating your time, but also thank you so much for your work and your relentless, unapologetic way of speaking up for Ukraine, explaining Ukraine, and also to trying to tell the rest of the world that the Ukrainian struggle is much larger than just Ukraine, and it's much closer to everyone's home than many people realize. So big thanks and velike dyakuju from all of us to your work.
Thank you.
And the rest of the folks, thank you so much for sticking around for the end of this broadcast. And also, if you're listening to this as a podcast, don't forget to rate us and comment. I know we say that all the time, but it does help, and it does help us to trend on podcast platforms. Which we are doing in several countries already. So thank you so much for that. But most importantly, great and huge thank you to our Patreon family. Your support is the only reason why we keep doing these important episodes week after week. And your support is so much appreciated. But also, if you're not our Patreon sponsor, but you liked what you hear and what you've heard just now, please consider joining us. You can find all the information at ukrainianspaces.com. And our sponsors get a lot of bonus stuff. So this is not a charity by any means. And you just have an opportunity to empower our mission to amplify more diverse Ukrainian voices and sometimes decolonize some of Ukraine conversations online. This is all for today. Apart from just one thing, is Slava Ukraini.